glasses and hey, keep recording, man.
Yeah, brother, like, stop. Right on.
There's too many of you crying. Brother, brother, brother.
All right. Welcome back to What's Going On with Earl Ingram. I'm joined once again by, I don't know, my counterpart. Can I call you my counterpart? What can I call you?
I don't know. Your flip side? I don't know.
No, I don't know. But we got to, I can say my friend. I think that covers it.
Yeah, absolutely. Yes.
The one and only Sandy Williams. Hey, good morning to you, Sandy. How you doing, man?
I'm doing well. It's Friday. It's bright, shiny Friday.
Hey, Sandy.
It's as it should be. Light.
Why do you keep saying what day it is? Does it matter?
No, I know. It's a way to keep track. You know, when you're in prison, you put a little notch on the wall just to figure out how many days it's been.
Oh, so you're equating retirement to prison?
No, gosh, no.
Listen, we got a lot to talk about this morning. But before we get into that, I was telling you a little story. I don't know, about 12, 15 years ago, I was selected. I was one of 25 people across the nation to be selected to go to what the military, the Army, used to do every year. They did this this All-American Bowl with the best high school players from all over the country, and they would do it down at San Antonio, and the name of it was the U.S. All-American Bowl, and it would take place in January. So I never forgot. One of the reasons I think they invited me was I used to, on the air, I would have the military come in at different times because I thought that young people who didn't know what they wanted to do, Sandy, it's not a bad starting place, right? You get to travel, see the world. And so I would have them come in and we would have conversations. So they somehow thought that was important enough to invite me and my wife to spend the weekend down in San Antonio. They treated us like, well, kind of like Sandy Williams treats me when I'm at his house.
I hope it's better than that.
So anyway, they were asking me, how would you like to jump out of an airplane? Sandy, I think I was about 60 years old, maybe about 58, somewhere around there. And I said, you know, and I'm letting my mouth override my common sense, and I'm, yeah, I'm going to do it. And I said, if more people in the audience say yes than no, I'm going to do it. And so more people said yes than no, Sandy. But what I didn't know.
Well, who did you think? Yeah.
I didn't realize that some of them probably didn't want to see me come back. So I couldn't figure that out at that point in time. So we get down to San Antonio. The Golden Knights, who are just an unbelievable group of daredevil guys, and I guess all the movie stars and George Bush Sr. at his 90th birthday jumped with them and all these kinds of things. So
yeah.
We're sitting down before on that morning, and they're saying, well, you're going to be 15,000 feet up. Well, Sandy, I couldn't figure what 15,000 feet was, right? How can I envision what 15,000 feet in the air is? But 15,000 feet was.
You can probably count to about 35 before you hit bottom.
So I didn't realize it's actually in the clouds or above the clouds.
Uh-huh.
And so we're sitting here and we're ready to go and they're telling us what to do and all those kind of things. And I'm still joking and laughing because this is not a big deal to me, right? Because my personality was just to have fun. And so we all of a sudden, the clouds didn't dissipate. And so they said, oh, by the way, we've been waiting an hour. Doesn't look like we're going to be able to do this today because the clouds won't let us. But what we'll do is we'll take you up anyway in the plane and give you an idea just how high 15,000 feet is. Mm-hmm. So we get in the plane, Sandy. The plane's probably 20 feet across. And they got this whole side completely open. And you're sitting 20 feet across and you're 15,000 feet up above the clouds. And they're giving you an idea that this is where you would be jumping from. And then they finally decided we're going to come back down. I got back on the ground. I said, thank you. Thank you, Jesus, for...
Yeah, and, the weather gods were good to you.
And just as I said that, mm-hmm. they said, oh, by the way, the clouds have dissipated. We're going to jump.
Oh.
So we went in, got to put the gear on, and there's about six of us. We get in this plane. We get up, and they had already taught us how to breathe and all those different things once we come out of the plane. And I see this guy who was a paratrooper, he said, in the military. But when he got close, they had a guy who would fall out of the plane backwards, Sandy, and videotape all of this, mm-hmm. right? And, you know, your face and facial expressions and all those things while you're falling, he's videotaping that. And so I saw the guy's eyes get bigger than watermelons when he went out the plane. I'm next. Guess what, Sandy? Once they get you up there, uh-huh. they're not. There's no way you're not going out, right?
No, it's, yeah.
it's going to happen. Whether you like it or not, it's going to happen. So the guy moves me up, and before you know it, boom, I'm out. And I have been bragging to the people. The guy said, well, you want to flip? Some of us, we can flip. We can do all these different things. I'm, yeah, I want to flip all the time. Let's flip. So I get outside. We're outside of the plane now, 15,000 feet up, Sandy. I forgot how to breathe. I'm thinking I'm going to pass out because I'm so frightened. Mm-hmm. I didn't even know how to stretch out and kind of all these kind of things. So finally, what seemed like an eternity, the guy finally pulls the ripcord. And I'm thinking, oh, it's finally over. But guess what, Sandy? When you pull the ripcord, air goes up underneath and shoots you back up. I don't know how many feet. And now, Sandy, I'm looking down, and the houses look like ants. And all I can think about is what happens if this thing breaks. So I finally get down to the ground. They run over with a camera. The guy sticks the camera in my face and says, so Earl, what do you think? I said, well, if they put $50,000 back up in that plane and said, Earl, if you go back up there, you can have the $50,000. I said, that kind of money I don't want nor need. It was an unbelievable experience. I just brought it up. I hadn't seen it in such a long time. But, you know, they got this stuff on YouTube and all them places. And it's still there. So when people say you're not telling the truth, I just Google it and there it is. But anyway.
I thought maybe you thought of it while you were doing your laundry.
Well, yeah. I get it. You catch my drift. Yeah, I get it. mm-hmm. Anyway, Sandy, let's have at it, man. We've got a lot to talk about. I wanted to talk with you about business first. And Sandy, we're at a time where the stock market is just, you know, it just doesn't seem to be coming to an end. And those who have stocks, they're in Shangri-La. And it just keeps exploding. I don't think you could have ever imagined. I remember our conversations years ago, Sandy. You couldn't have imagined the stock market being where it is now.
No, I don't think. Well, I don't think analysts in the stock market could have imagined that it would keep going up and getting to this point. And there is no doubt that it's getting up there at the level of pretty lofty pricing in terms of the price of the stock as compared to the earnings of the company, and that keeps going up. Part of it is that the U.S. economy continues to be doing better than other economies. That doesn't mean it's doing so well. It's just that other economies are not doing so very well. And part of that has to do with U.S. policies that have kind of put a knife into some of the other economies. You know, our tariff policy is hurting Canada. It's hurting a bunch of countries in England in terms of how they're doing. But it's true, never been more true, that people who own assets today in the United States are getting rich at a terrifically rapid rate, while people who don't own assets are struggling. And so that's kind of created this social economic divide in this country. If you have assets, you think you're wealthy. If you just work for a paycheck and you haven't accumulated assets, you're feeling a terrific pinch.
So Sandy, there's and that group of people who don't have the assets is growing. And so we've got a president who talks about the people with assets, the greatest time in the history of this nation, but he fails to talk about all the American citizens who don't have those assets, who are struggling mightily.
Well, it's interesting because he talks about the golden age, the gilded age. And if you look back at the gilded age of the United States, which was the last quarter of the 19th century, 1875 to 1900 or 1913 thereabouts, that was the same situation. So there were people getting mightily rich who owned assets and owned things. And all the workaday people were working stiffs who ultimately needed the protections that were created under the New Deal to keep them from being overly exploited in the labor unions. It's definitely we've got a current government, I think, that's highly focused on measuring people's wealth as compared to their assets, which is the way you accumulate wealth. But I don't think it's focused enough on the affordability issue, which people are talking about. But, you know, we can talk about that another day, the issue of whether affordability is the shortage of incomes to buy the things that are needed, or whether affordability is caused by a shortage of supply of stuff that's made it scarce, so it's harder to buy it and it's all become more expensive, or a combination of the two. And I think that can be a fertile conversation for another day. But we definitely have an economy that's in a great deal of flux. One of the things that's driving the current economy is all of this bullishness in the future about artificial intelligence. And if you look at the values on the stock markets, particularly NASDAQ, and there are a bunch of corporations who are doing very, very well right now, extraordinarily well, who are entirely, their future seems to be entirely rested in artificial intelligence and what it might do. For instance, the corporation NVIDIA. NVIDIA makes chips that are very singularly important for artificial intelligence, and it's almost got a monopoly on the market of making the sophisticated chips that can drive artificial intelligence. It was only about 10 years ago, it was in the last decade, I'm quite sure, that the very first corporation in America, their market value in terms of the value of all of their stock on the stock market exceeded $1 trillion. I think Amazon or Apple were the first corporations whose combined value of all their outstanding stock, if you multiply the number of shares times the value of each share, that number exceeded $1 billion. Today, NVIDIA's stock on the market, the market value of that stock in total, exceeds $4 trillion, which is just an unheard of number, and it's a demonstration of how much value investors are putting in and speculators are putting in the notion that artificial intelligence is going to be extremely valuable.
So, Sandy, how old is NVIDIA? It's not like it's been around forever. It's a relatively new company, right?
Yeah, I think I can't tell you when it was founded, but I would guess it was founded in the 1990s in all likelihood. It's probably 35 years old.
For that kind of growth over a 35-year period is kind of unheard of, right?
Well, absolutely. I mean, that's one of the things that's happened with the new economy, is that with new technologies, the new technologies come on the market much more quickly, and the corporations that are benefiting from those technologies technologies develop value in the stock market very much more quickly. So, you know, the biggest corporations in America, Amazon, Apple, Microsoft, all of these corporations didn't exist before computers became prevalent. Most of them didn't have significant market value until after the year 2000. Amazon was losing money and was operating out of a garage selling books in the year probably 1995, 1998. And today Amazon is, I think, the second or third largest corporation by market value.
So when you talk about chips, for those of us who are not in tune, I know that the minerals that are necessary to produce those chips, the quality of the chips, I heard the president talk about, you know, and there are many different chips, but the quality of the chips and all those different things, and those are, in order to produce the chips, you need minerals, special minerals, I guess, that China happens to have a lot of those. Ukraine happens to have a lot of the minerals necessary to make these chips. And it's not something that the United States has a lot of. So how much of the future is tied into those who can produce the chips? I mean, you can't do any of those things without the chips.
Yeah, chip manufacturing, there's also a great deal of sophistication involved with it, technology, innovation. So NVIDIA has been able to develop very dense, very powerful chips. I mean, if you think about a chip, if you can think about an old-fashioned radio that had tubes in it, or a television that had tubes in it, a chip will have all of the circuitry that was involved in a big thing like a television in one little chip, and the chip is, you know, is no bigger than your fingernail.
Wow.
And in it is all kinds of electronics that have been miniaturized to the point that goes really beyond your imagination for miniaturization. And these chips are capable of a great deal. So, you know, the receivers that operate in data centers are utilized chips, and they use many, many chips. Each of the chips has particular functions, and the chips are driven by electricity. And so what you end up with in AI is many receivers. A receiver is an electronic appliance. Looks pretty much like the old receivers used to look in a stereo set, except that receiver for a data center is simply filled with circuitry and chips and uses a great deal of electricity and would be apt to get very hot based on all the electricity flowing through all those chips with the resistance that they pose for the chips, were it not for cooling to be used to keep the data center and its chips from melting from the heat that would otherwise be created by all the electricity being used. And there's a great deal of electricity used then for the cooling as well. So data centers are gigantic users of electricity, and the chips that have been developed, particularly by NVIDIA, are very dense and very high users of electricity.
So, Sandy, this whole AI that appears to have just come into existence in a very short period of time, because I know it's been on the upswing for more than just a short period of time that it seems to be the one thing that everybody's talking about. But why is it all of a sudden now that it's exploded to the degree that it has?
Well, first of all, what is AI? AI is really the capacity of a computer to assimilate a great deal of information, okay? And with the internet has come the ability of people and things to reach out and find out what it is that's known by the internet. And the internet has become increasingly dense with information, so that, for instance, the college I went to had a library called Widener Library that was the biggest private library in the world. And to do research, you used to go into Widener Library and you'd use the Dewey Decimal System and chase down all these documents that you needed to look at. And you'd go in the microfiche room and you'd look at microfiche and you'd spend hours and days trying to dig up all this data. Well, today, Google you ask Google a question, and Google has the ability to go to look at data, not just the stuff that would be in Widener Library, but the stuff that exists anywhere in the world that is connected to the internet that is related to the question you're asking it. It can reach out and see that. And so then the question is, okay, if you've got the capacity to reach out and see all of that data instantaneously and see all that information instantaneously, maybe there's a way to massage that data and to manipulate that data and to assimilate that data and to understand it, not just by rote giving it back to you. So Google is the capacity to basically go out and tell you what's there. It goes out and finds, it's like having access to the biggest Encyclopedia Britannica you can imagine. You ask it a question, it goes out and finds the answer, but it's finding the answer by simply finding a place that has the answer to that question. But if you ask the, if you'd ask the computer last year, how many red cars were driven that had automobile accidents as compared to blue, red, silver, or black cars? And as far as you can tell, is there any relationship between the number of accidents experienced by red cars because they're red? Okay. Now an AI source could go out and would look at all that stuff, would do comparisons between all the different colors of cars, would look at accident data, and it would come back to you and say, no, you're full of hooey. There's nothing about red cars that makes them more prone to accidents. Or it might come back and say, wow, you have asked a very interesting question. And it turns out that red cars have more accidents than almost any other color of car. And we haven't yet determined a reason, but here are several of the things that it might be caused by. And so that's the kind of, so what happened was people began, because we had access to all this data, the way Google does, Google and other people who understood the kind of data access they had began to think, aha, we can set up systems that will use the internet and will simultaneously go out and look at all this data, and then we can develop mathematical algorithms that will run correlations and comparisons that look at coincidences or correlations that might exist between various kinds of data that will give us information that might be important that we would never have thought of before, or that we thought of but now we can prove or disprove the connections between them. And it's that kind of manipulation of data that has generated the AI industry and a realization that AI can be used to assimilate all this data, compare it, analyze it. Okay, and the analysis is the intelligence part of it. It's taking data and actually reaching conclusions about the data that could be reached by a human being, but it's being reached by a machine now who's looking at the same kind of things that a human being would do. So I won't talk at great length here, but let's take a medical diagnosis. A doctor, you come in and see a doctor, you tell him your symptoms, you got a sore throat, your ear hurts, your nose is running, you've got a red eye. I'm kind of defining myself right now. And you'd like to know what's wrong with you. And the doctor asks you a couple of more questions, you give him a couple of more answers about what you're doing. And he uses his experience to say, yeah, I think you've got a virus or whatever. You could feed that into AI, and AI would run out and would say, you know what, there seems to be thousands of these kind of cases coming up right now. We're seeing it a lot. We're seeing it a lot in Wisconsin. We're seeing it a lot here. We're seeing it a lot there. Also, it would say that, you know, and we found out that these cases seem to be accompanied by the following. And so the data access could be used for medical diagnosis, as well as the experience that is built into the computer and into the information to be able to help with diagnosis. And that's artificial intelligence.
So, Sandy, this sounds like the Twilight Zone or the Outer Limits. And so if you it's not finite, the knowledge that can be garnered through this. I mean, there are surgeries and doctors that are using kind of artificial intelligence when it comes to doing operations.
Well, absolutely. And you know, and we're the better for it because I've got a doctor I go to who's developed, has an invention that basically uses artificial intelligence to find and mine all of the data associated with a certain heart procedure. It understands how the outcomes on those procedures went over time. It knows exactly where the placement of this particular thing was put into the heart, and it's being used real time to help doctors do a better job of making the decision about exactly how to do the procedure that will improve the likelihood of success of the procedure. And so, you know, and AI has all kinds of applications. I mean, you know, if you are a lawyer and you would call a young lawyer into your office and say, I'd like you to go out and research and find all the cases that talk about this, okay, this particular issue. I'd like you to list the cases, and I'd like you to give me the portion of the case that has the discussion of this particular issue, and I'd like you to summarize the results that you find about those cases with those issues. And a young lawyer would go out and use the comparable to the Dewey Decimal System to chase around and look in books and find this out. Or now today, you can plug that all into an artificial intelligence process, which will be able to go out and, number one, act like Google, find all those cases that have that in it, but then two, begin to analyze what it is that's said in each of the cases and whether what's being said in each case is consistent or inconsistent, which ones run along the same line and which ones run along different lines. And so now, if you're a young lawyer, if you get called, you'll do this, the best thing you can do is tell the partner exactly how you're going to use artificial intelligence to get this done quickly, and then you're going to provide him with the outcome from that. But it's also going to make you, the young lawyer, do it much more quickly. There's not going to be need to be as many of you young lawyers in a law firm in order to accomplish the output that firm used to have.
So, Sandy, the applications of artificial intelligence, as you pointed out, are only going to make life a lot easier, a lot better in the long run for the American people. But the flip side of it is at the expense of many of the American people. I mean, prime example, what? Sandy, in San Francisco and other places where the cabs, they no longer need to have a person in the cab driving it. They've kind of gone all in on driverless cabs. You know, well, there are a lot of people who made a living driving cabs.
Yeah, I mean, you know, the futurists and, you know, Elon Musk and people who think about the future are talking about the fact that the productivity of people who do the kinds of things I was describing, young bankers who do analysis for deals, you know, or do analysis of the stock market or do analysis of whatever, people who do analysis, people who are used to be relying on personal experience, years of experience, because they would have assimilated all kinds of knowledge over those years of experience. But a lot of those years of experience can now be replaced by this artificial intelligence process, which can go out and assimilate all of that experience, not just of one person, but the experience of everyone in a particular field and bring that forward. So what does that mean? That means that people are going to become much, much more productive. And unless this increased productivity creates and fosters new kinds of businesses that require many more new employees, with this heightened productivity, we're going to find that the current number of workers aren't needed to do what's currently being done for as many hours as is currently needed. So in some futurists are saying, you know, maybe what's going to happen in the distant future is people are going to be used to working 10-hour weeks instead of 40-hour weeks, and we'll have as many employees, but they'll all just work 10 hours. Well, I don't know exactly sociologically how we shift gears to that kind of an extent to make, you know, to have four times, you know, to have a whole whole lot of people working just a little bit rather than just some people working quite a bit.
So, Sandy.
But that's the kind of sociological problem we can see. How are we going to divide the profits that are made amongst the many people in the world?
So, Sandy, artificial intelligence didn't just start. I mean, if we think about, you know, when the pilot is flying a plane and they put it on autopilot, that's artificial intelligence, right?
Autopilot didn't quite get to be artificial intelligence. It was the assimilation directly of data. It was if X is happening, then Y happens. It was linear, and there weren't judgments being made. Artificial intelligence is really defined by when you've got a bunch of information, and the correlations between them can be viewed in a number of different ways, and the artificial intelligence assimilates that and data and makes decisions about what is the likely relationship.
So Sandy, let's say artificial intelligence is going to make it a lot more possible that we will be going to Mars, maybe not in your and my lifetime, but it certainly makes it more plausible than it did before. Is it safe to say that?
Well, we will be going to Mars. We will be sending things to Mars.
Yeah, sure.
But with sufficient artificial intelligence, we needn't send human beings, unless we decide that human beings are less valuable than the non-human artificial intelligence devices we would otherwise send. I'm confident that with artificial intelligence will come the capacity to take much greater risks that we would not otherwise put human beings in the position of taking in order to develop new knowledge.
You know, Sandy, you talked about, you know, building these huge centers. And I mean, they're just massive in the amount of acreage that they take up. And those things are clearly just, they're monstrous when you look at the size of them, and they're springing up everywhere.
Well, and it isn't just the size of them. I mean, the size of them is the size of huge warehouses, and that would be one thing. But what's really remarkable about data centers is the amount of electricity they use. So a very common size for a data center right now. In fact, data centers are talked about in size based on their electricity usage, okay? So a 200 megawatt data center is kind of the standard big data center being built today. That means that the data center needs 200 megawatts of electricity to operate. 200 megawatts of electricity, just to put it into scale, is enough to provide almost the entire city of Milwaukee with electricity. 200 megawatts is more than enough to provide the city of Madison with all the electricity it needs. And so what you've got is a data center whose size is measured in acres, using as much electricity as an entire city. 200 megawatts is not a small electric generating plant. There are data centers being planned. There's one that was just announced being planned for Cheyenne, Wyoming. And its planned size to start with is 1,800 megawatts of electricity. That's 9 200 megawatt generating plants. That's 1.8 gigawatts is bigger than any electric generating plant in the state of Wisconsin. The Oak Creek generating plant, which is the biggest generating units in the state of Wisconsin, generates a combined total of 1.2 gigawatts, 1,200 megawatts of electricity. There's a data center in Cheyenne, Wyoming, that will require 1.5 Oak Creek power plants to operate it, and it's projected that data center will grow to be 10 gigawatts in size. Now, 10 gigawatts is more gigawatts. The entire state of Wisconsin, electric usage is 17.5 gigawatts. So there's an electric power plant being proposed for Cheyenne, Wyoming, which will use more than half as much electricity as the entire state of Wisconsin.
And
There are many, many 200 megawatt to 500 megawatt data centers being planned around the country.
And Sandy, they all need water. Let me ask you, does it have to be, can salt water work, or does it have to be any water?
Well, salt water is difficult to handle because it corrodes the things that it flows through. But it needs to be water that can run through a system that can be used for cooling. Liquid cooling has become the norm now for these very big power plants. Liquid cooling operating more or less like the radiator of your car to circulate water around the equipment that is getting hot to exchange heat into the water and to carry the heat away in the water. The other thing about these data centers is that they're going to provide all this sourceage for the source of computational support for artificial intelligence that will replace a lot of jobs. But data centers don't employ many people. So that there's an Oracle data center in Texas that was just built that was 200 megawatts in size. It employs 57 full-time people. 57 can operate that unit. Maybe a more normal operating staff level might be 100 people for a 200 megawatt unit data center. The 1.8 gigawatt data center is going to employ more than 100 people, but it's not going to employ 900 people.
So the
employees that will be created, the jobs that will be created by these data centers, is nothing like the number of jobs that would be potentially consumed by the higher productivity created by artificial intelligence.
So, Sandy, artificial intelligence is driving the growth of the stock market. And so it's really what's feeding it. And yet this continued growth that we see, is it something that, you know, is going to continue at the rate or increase, or is there a chance that you mentioned something about a bubble, that there can be a bubble at the end of this?
No, I think there are plenty of people, particularly stock analysts and others, who are watching all of this and are worried about whether this is a bubble, because what's happening is that the scale of announced new data centers and the amount of money that's being devoted to the construction of all of these new announced data centers is ginormous, if that's a word. It is really off the charts in terms of the level of private investment in infrastructure that has ever occurred in this country. I mean, it's many billions of dollars and trillions of dollars looking forward. You can look at the biggest investors in this: Microsoft, Amazon. Amazon has announced some huge investment plans for going forward with respect to, and these plans going forward are, the amount of money that's involved is $150 billion projected for expenditures, or $130 billion. And if you total it all up, we're talking about trillions of dollars of projected new investment for data centers, which will come online in the next 4 years. And of course, these data centers aren't yet in use. They aren't yet constructed. So they're being constructed in expectation that there will be a future demand for this, for the use of all these data centers, which will pay back the investment in them. And, you know, most of these are being built by 50% debt, potentially. So there's going to be loans that have to be repaid by the revenue that's generated from all of these new data centers.
Sandy, so
there are some who are sanguine and say, oh, yeah, there's such a shortage of data centers, these are all going to get consumed and quickly used, and the revenue will be generated. There are others who are saying, yeah, things that go this fast and things that leapfrog forward this fast tend to burst like a bubble.
So Sandy, the people who are really investing in these things, clearly it's not the average Joe. You're not going to be able to buy into those data centers for the most part, and probably a good thing, because the risk is so high.
Yeah. the size of, well, first of all, many of the people building these are not names that you've heard of. It isn't Meta and AWS, Amazon website, web systems, and others are not the ones building all of these, although they are investing substantial amounts of money. But there are a number of developers that are building these data centers that I'm describing. In fact, there's a 600 megawatt data center in Kansas being built by a developer, not by one of the major names. This 1.8 gigawatt data center in Cheyenne is being built by developers, not by any of the standard names you would understand as being the providers of cloud and AI web service. So there are many, many investors, whether it be private equity, putting equity into it, whether it's corporations that are investing in it. Now, a number of these businesses do have investments in them by the likes of Meta and Amazon and others. But these are collective investments in the trillion of dollar type measurements to be built in the next 4 years to meet demand which is not yet in existence. And so, you know, is that risky? Yes, it definitely involves risk.
So the stock market, again, the correlation between what has happened with artificial intelligence and this continued explosion of the stock market go hand in hand. So at a given point in time, Sandy, and you talked about this bubble, the average person who's kind of engaged in the market, who's kind of seeing unbelievable growth themselves, and the little guy who's there, does he risk being hurt or damaged if this does become the bubble?
Well, look, if a bubble of this scale bursts, the splatter will hit everyone.
Okay.
It's kind of like when the housing bubble went, everyone wasn't participating in a failed house, but the failure of the market hit everyone. And I think right now the stock market numbers are buoyed so much by artificial intelligence related businesses. So, I mean, if you look at the stock market and if you took out of the stock market all of those corporations which are heavily dependent upon or related to electronic computation, artificial intelligence, or providing the infrastructure to those industries, you'd find a stock market that was not soaring anywhere near as high as the current stock market is. Much of the growth in the stock market is from the seven biggest companies, all of which are highly dependent upon, related to the computer / artificial intelligence industry.
So this is a perfect storm, if you will, as it relates to the stock market. And a perfect storm doesn't remain that way forever. Let me ask you, Sandy.
I'm not saying it is a storm. I'm saying it is a risk. You know, it could be. There are some, like I said, who are sanguine that all of this demand that we're forecasting for AI will materialize, and that it might even materialize more rapidly and more grandly than forecast, in which case all of this stuff that's being constructed will do swimmingly well, and that could happen. It's just that it's remarkable. It will be remarkable if that's the case, because this is an unheard of level of private investment in infrastructure at a rate that's really never been seen before.
So, Sandy, we talked about some of the positive aspects of AI and, you know, some of the negative aspects of AI. Let's talk about it from the perspective of the Generation Zs and Ys, and how this plays out in their positions as they move forward in their lives.
Well, there is one thing we didn't talk about with AI, and that is that the corroboration and the verification of what you get out of artificial intelligence is still a little bit of a problem. You know, the potential for AI to run up blind alleys or run up false alleys is very much there, because it's not yet very good at discerning the difference between something which is totally credible and things which might be non-credible or incredible. And so there is a lot of work that needs to be done, and there's a lot of human input that will be required over the long term to make sure that AI becomes increasingly accurate and increasingly trustworthy. But one of the ways that AI has, you know, emerged and come into onto the scene quite rapidly is in the college and school setting. You can ask ChatGPT, anyone can do it. You can pick up your phone, ask ChatGPT to write you an essay. Just tell it what you want the essay, what subject matter you want. Give it whatever information you have about that subject matter. Tell it how many words you want the essay to be. Give it some other notions about the ways you'd like the essay to read or subject matters that it might emphasize. And a minute later,
yes,
you'll get an essay that'll read pretty well and will meet all of these criteria you set for it. And you could turn around and hand that in to the teacher, because what you did is you just read AI the assignment that you got from the teacher, and AI just provided the answer. And increasingly, in many settings, people have worried about this question of the ethics of students using AI to respond to assignments, and what is the ethics of that and what's allowed. There have been programs that have been developed that are designed to examine the essay to tell the professor what the likelihood is that that essay was written by AI rather than by the student. And apparently those programs are getting increasingly capable. And so now AI is having to maybe learn how to do a better job of evading those discriminating programs that will otherwise find out that the student has written it by AI. But the question in the long run is going to be, how do we best use AI? Do we worry about people using AI to do something that they could otherwise do themselves? Or are what we most interested in is making sure that we use AI on the basis of it providing the very best information back that can be provided, and moving the ball forward in the way of knowledge in the best possible way?
You know, Sandy, it's one thing to talk about it from the perspective of the college student and the professor. It's another thing, I think, altogether different when you're in the high schools and middle schools, where I think young people need to learn some basics. I think you and I were having a conversation earlier, and you were saying, well, maybe we're at a point where they don't need to figure out how to divide in the manner that you and I learned.
Well, I was saying, you know, It's a difficult, I think, question, and it'll be an interesting question in terms of how society resolves it, in terms of what we need to do from a rote standpoint in the learning process to learn how to do things that we might later rely on other things to do on our behalf. When I was young, we used to have to learn how to find the square root of a number. And that was a fairly complicated mathematical process. I don't think they even bother to teach it anymore. You just ask your phone to find the square root of any number, and it finds it instantaneously. And all that's really important is you know what the square root means. What is that? It's the number times itself, which equals the number you're talking about. That's its square root. And if you know that, you really know everything you need to know about square roots. And now you can apply the principle of square roots to problems without worrying about spending 25 minutes finding the square root of 6,946. Now you extrapolate from that concept to how much do we need to know how to research in the library to find the answer to a particular problem, or do we just need to be able to ask the right question of an electronic process which will immediately get back to us with the answer to that problem? And I think it's pretty clear that that too will become like the square root. We aren't going to have to know the Dewey Decimal System. We're not going to have to know how to do that whole process in order to be well educated. But we do get down to this question of how about writing? How about writing skills? Do we need to learn writing skills, or can we simply rely on AI to write it for us? And I do believe that it will be important that people learn how to communicate and learn the skills of writing and learn the skills of communication before they turn that job over to an automated intelligence process to create at least the first draft of something on their behalf.
You know, Sandy, long term, as you and I, as we're having this conversation, and this is still the early stages of AI and what AI will be able to do. But, you know, whether or not a young person who's in school right now today and is being taught in the old manner that you and I were being taught, we had to do it at that point in time because there was no AI, and we had to prove that we knew how to communicate and do those things, and we had to learn those skill sets. You really don't need to learn those anymore, do you?
Well, it's a question of what skill sets you need to learn. I've got a grandson who's a sophomore in college. He's in a special program at his university, which is devoted to the application of artificial intelligence and the knowledge, learning knowledge about the tools that use artificial intelligence for application to the finance and real estate industries. And when he gets done with school, instead of being someone who will be replaced by AI, he will be someone who will take with him the knowledge about how to harness AI in the best possible ways for application in particular settings. And I think that in many ways, that's the direction education is going to go generally. It's not going to be to teach you things which will put you in competition with artificial intelligence. It will teach you how to use artificial intelligence to move the ball forward in whatever field of endeavor you're involved in as rapidly and as efficiently and as well as possible. And that process might well create a whole bunch of new businesses that we haven't even thought about,
which will be
available and possible because of this capacity.
So, Sandy, in the business world, whole departments would possibly be eliminated. I know I was asking you about being an attorney and all the books and things that you guys have, you know, that you have to, people have to do research in, yeah. You know, no longer the case.
Well, I think AI replaces two different fundamental things. One of them is involved with those people who are experienced in an industry and who are called upon to apply years of their personal experience and knowledge because of the knowledge and wisdom they've gained from that experience. They can charge more per hour and they're more valuable because they have all this built-up experience. Well, AI can replace experience in many ways. I, as a lawyer, knew from the many transactions I was in, I had a great deal of knowledge about how to build a transaction involved with the energy industry, but I didn't know everything about every transaction. In today's world, I could go to an AI tool and I could ask it to assimilate for me and describe for me all the various ways that people have dealt with this particular issue in an energy transaction of this particular kind, and it would give me a great deal of information, and it would give it to me whether I had 40 years of experience or whether I was simply in my fourth or fifth year working in the law firm. And so, to some extent, AI can supplant personal experience. Another way that it can supplant is the kind of more rote work that junior people in law firms and in investment banks and other places might work, which is assimilating a broad array of data, putting it into spreadsheets or putting it into the memos that summarize the information that might be involved in 500 depositions or about a particular rule of law and all the cases that have dealt with it, or about a corporation and the industry in which the corporation resides and all kinds of information there. AI will be very good at assimilating all kinds of data, summarizing that data, plugging it into Excel spreadsheets, or creating a memo that summarizes it. And so places like investment banks and law firms are realizing that their personnel tree that used to look like a pyramid is going to begin to look like a pillar. And the numbers of people who come in the bottom is no longer going to be five times as many people as the number of people near the top. It's going to be something much different.
So Sandy,
that's a big social change.
But Sandy, that's the trends. These were areas where these people would cut their teeth before they could move into the meat and potatoes of what an attorney is.
Yes, and for some, you know, for some places, let's say a service organization like a law firm or an investment bank or others, where you had that pyramid shape, part of getting quality at the top, you know, it's the old dairy farm kind of expression. The more milk you have, the more cream you get.
Right.
And the more cream you get, the better the quality. And so if you have a big volume at the bottom and you're culling and finding talent and you're taking only the most talented people and moving them to the top, you have an evolutionary process that means that basically the top will be much more cream-like than otherwise would be the case. If the shape of the organization is more like a pillar, you don't have that same capacity to cull and so it will change how things operate within companies. It'll change possibly this ability to move the best and the brightest upwards. Maybe it'll require that you only hire the best and the brightest in the bottom. How do you know? So it's going to change the environment of workplaces in many ways, and it's going to create a lot of social, economic, business propositions that are heretofore not worried about.
So, Sandy, let's take the trade you are in, law firms. So all the different universities that are out here that are cultivating and educating people to become barristers, to become attorneys, if you're looking at the long-term prospects of that, would you still tell as many young people that this is the right place to go, or would you say that predicated on how things are looking right now, you might hedge on that?
Well, there's a lot of hedging going on. The job market for people moving into a bunch of service organizations right now is very tight for new graduates, because all these service organizations are trying to weigh and understand and project how much artificial intelligence is going to drive down their demand for these new incoming laborers. And so they're taking it very slowly in terms of the numbers of people they're hiring. And that's already being experienced in the job market today. And so these young people are already getting a sense of that from the word they're getting about how easy it is or not to find the job of their dreams.
You know, Sandy, this is kind of the beginning of this subject matter that is going to continue to evolve. And hopefully you and I will be around long enough to continue the conversation about its evolution.
And I'm not a bot, and you're not a bot. But 10 years from now, who knows?
All right, my friend, we'll talk later. All right.
See you.
We'll leave it there for now.